Well, you know, at the time of the Buddha, when people first came to the Buddha to practice with him, especially lay people, the first thing that he would do is he would teach them about dana, about generosity. He wasn't so much interested in the dana basket. He, you know, his needs were pretty much cared for by people, and it was a very different culture, and people wanted to do that more. Many of you have been to Asia, and you know the experience, just the relationship, the whole relationship with dana is just so different there. But so the first thing he would do is he would teach people generosity. And when people were sufficiently grounded and had really developed their understanding of generosity, and he felt to some extent that they had a strong enough understanding and relationship with it, then he would turn to sila, to teaching them about ethical conduct and ethical behavior, however you'd like to translate that. And then he would have them work with that for a while. And once they were fully grounded, or grounded enough, once they really had a pretty solid grasp and a somewhat clear understanding of that, then he would move on to bhavana, the third pillar of practice. Bhavana, meditation, or I guess the actual translation is development, but generally that was the part where he taught meditation. And at that point, he might have instructed you to go into the forest, sit at the root of a tree, and start by gladdening the mind. And you see this in the discourses a fair amount. In meditation, there are the twin paths of samatha, or clear abiding, calm abiding, excuse me, and samatha, the calm abiding, which leads to samadhi, a collected and unified mind, like you were talking about, and vipassana, or insight, which leads to panya, or wisdom. And so these two, and there's actually been this debate going on for, well, at least the last 20 years or 30 years, but my guess is over the last few thousand years it's been a big deal. Some people saying, oh no, you need to go the path of samadhi, you know, no, you need to go the path of, the path of samatha, no, you need the path of vipassana, you need the insight. When in reality, I'm not sure that you can really separate the two, you know. I think maybe in some states, in deep jhana, when you're actually in jhana, there is not insight there. But as soon as you come out, the insight is so much stronger based on how much more collected and unified the mind is there. So I found some references in the discourses, and also in from some other scholars, some other Buddhist scholars, as to what they had to say about gladdening the mind. And the first one is from Thanissaro Bhikkhu. And he says, so the proper path is one in which vipassana and samatha are brought into balance, each supporting and acting as a check on the other. Vipassana helps keep tranquility from becoming stagnant and dull. Samatha helps prevent the manifestations of aversion that can occur when the mind is trapped against its will in the present moment. From this description, it's obvious that samatha and vipassana are not separate paths of practice, but instead are complementary ways of relating to the present moment. Samatha brings a sense of ease in the present. Vipassana, a clear-eyed view of events as they actually occur, in and of themselves. It's also obvious why these two qualities need to function together in mastering jhana. Jhana, the meditative absorptions, where the any kind of separation, any kind of duality falls away, and there is just the present moment awareness. There's no person aware of it or anything like that. It's complete, that unification of mind that happens, that can happen. As the standard instructions on breath meditation indicate, such a mastery involves three things: gladdening, concentrating, and liberating the mind. Gladdening means finding a sense of refreshment and satisfaction in the present. Concentrating means keeping the mind focused on its object, while liberating means freeing the mind from the grosser factors making up a lower stage of concentration so as to attain a higher stage. The first two activities are functions of samatha, while the last is a function of vipassana. All three must function together. the gladdening, the concentration, and the liberating. So, and this is an excerpt from, there were a number of discourses where the Buddha talked about mindfulness of breathing. This is one of those. Monks, concentration through mindfulness of in and out breathing, when developed and pursued, is of great fruit, of great benefit. And how is concentration through mindfulness of in and out breathing developed and pursued so as to be of great benefit, of great fruit? There is the monk who, having gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree, develops these things, right? And in that discourse, there were actually 16 steps, which mirrors the, many of you are familiar with the Satipatthana Sutta, the four ways of establishing awareness. And we start with awareness of the body, and go to awareness of Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither. And then to awareness of the mind, or mindfulness of the mind. And in that part, you know, one trains oneself. I'll breathe in gladdening the mind. One trains oneself. I'll breathe out gladdening the mind. And so it goes through all of these different steps and stages. So that is where gladdening is deliberately part of a practice that comes a little, may come a little later on. You know, that's 16 steps, and gladdening is in the four part, the quartet, having to do with the mind, which is in the third part. But it can also come earlier in there. As Tan Jeff says in one of his commentaries, his guide on the 10 recollections, if the mind needs gladdening, one can breathe in ways that induce rapture and pleasure. If this can't be accomplished with the breath, he suggests using any of the recollections that will produce the desired effect. So it's skillful to reflect on the Buddha, to reflect on the monastics. I did this a lot on the retreat, and it was the retreat that I was on in March, and it was really wonderful, just really seeing that, that you can actually reflect on these things, that they all do, that you can use these quite skillfully to calm and steady the mind, so that then you can turn it towards Vipassana, towards the insight, and see that more clearly. It really gives a sense of that possibility. In another discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya, Tan Jeff is translating, and the Buddha there is talking about the four ways of establishing mindfulness, and you start focusing on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful. As many of you have heard, that's in the discourse on the Satipatthana, the four ways of establishing mindfulness. Ardent and alert and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. As one remains thus focused on the body in and of itself, a fever based on the body arises within one's body, or there is sluggishness in one's awareness, or one's mind becomes scattered externally. So this is probably more realistic in terms of what we may experience. We're trying to stay with an object, but then we get knocked off track in one way or another, yeah? But this is the actual Buddha speaking there. One should then direct one's mind to any inspiring theme, such as recollection of the Buddha, wholesome acts one has done. As one's mind is directed to any inspiring theme, delight arises within one. Yeah? So we can actually have that happen. And then from there it goes on through the other of the ways of establishing awareness. In one excerpt, so this is the Buddha talking. In one excerpt, the Buddha recommends three areas for experimentation. Notice how to gladden the mind when it needs gladdening. This is similar to the first excerpt from Tan Jeff. Notice how to steady it when it needs steadying, and how to release it from its attachments and burdens when it's ready for release. sometimes the gladdening and steadying will require bringing in other topics for contemplation. For instance, to gladden the mind, you can develop an attitude of infinite goodwill, or recollect the times in the past when you've been virtuous or generous. In Philip's book, Emotional Chaos to Clarity, chapter 11 is about gratitude. We can reflect on gratitude in this way and really see, he has this, it takes up almost a full page in there, in this chapter 11, where he talks about just reflecting on everything that came to be here. He's like, you know, maybe you're just drinking your tea, but did you reflect on everything that's involved there? You know, and we can do that here. You know, we're sitting in this room. People came here to set up early so we could do this. This room was also built by people who, to a greater or lesser degree, had some sense of integrity. At the very least, integrity about their work, yeah? And this room's held up for a while now. It has a lot of light to it. The windows keep the wind out. They let the light in. You know, where did these windows come from? People made the glass here. People installed it. There's metal around there that came from the earth. People built that. The floors, the foundation, everything here. The lights that we have turned on here. We don't need so much yet, but give it a few minutes and it'll start to get a little darker. You know, all of this kind of thing. We can see all of this here. The chairs that we're sitting on. Where did they come from? There's metal. There's some foam. There's some naga hide from the last of the wild nagas. Right? Yeah. The firm boards underneath them. Some screws that were involved there. All different things. These plastic things on the bottom. There may be elements that we, you know, feel more attracted to or less so. But we can really see this, how all of these things come together in everything. When we're driving a car, there's a road. This parking lot is paved out here. And there's a driveway that leads up here. We get to come up. And we'll, pretty much everybody here, except for a few of you who live very close, potentially could walk home. But the rest of us will be driving home. You know? Skillful to reflect on these kinds of things. So, why do this gladdening of the mind-heart? And I'm using the terms interchangeably, mind-heart. I am pretty sure that the term that's being translated here as mind was the word citta, which if you go ask any of the Asian teachers, they'll say, oh, citta, in the mind, look in the mind. You know, so they don't have that, they don't have that distinction that we have there. So why to do this? Well, it's certainly a wholesome practice. It leads towards wholesome mental states. It does serve to calm the mind. As the mind gets more calm, the mind can get more gathered and collected and unified. And with that, then, the ability to have insight can be stronger. The hindrances can be at bay, or at least at that point, once you get to like that level of, I'm sure you've heard Philip talk about neighborhood concentration, we don't need to have perfect concentration. We don't need to be able to get to jhana. But if we can get the concentration strong enough, the hindrances, maybe they're gone or they're subdued at least. So when they do come, they're not so totally overpowering. We can actually look at them and investigate them. At that point, the hindrances are allies to our practice. They are allies to the deepening of our practice, to the deepening of insight. It can create more of a sense of fluidity in the heart and more ease. Do we have any aversive types here tonight? Yeah, some of you? Well, we've got some aversive types, we've got some greed types, some deluded types. We've got them all. And everybody gets everything, of course. A great, skillful antidote for, if you're a particularly strong aversive type, it can be a quite useful antidote to that. Something that you could work with over a period of time. Can help us get unstuck if we're really stuck. We don't have to, and I wouldn't recommend using it as a way to get rid of the unpleasant, you know. Then that's just another manifestation of aversion. Yeah, we have to see that. But at the same time, when aversion gets really strong and overpowering, it's skillful to move to some other subject. That's why loving kindness is so often offered as an antidote to aversion, to aversive mind states. It is a proximate cause of concentration. It's a samatha practice, a calm abiding practice that leads to that more collected and unified mind. In AA, I'm not an AA person myself, though some people who have been in AA, some friends of mine have been in there, they've talked about the grateful alcoholic. And I really could not grasp that at all. And then on this last retreat, really as I was doing this gladdening of the mind practice, quite clearly seeing that everybody in that meditation hall got their due to dukkha. And really having gratitude for the dukkha in our life. Gratitude for the dukkha in my life. That the dukkha in my life had been strong enough to bring me to practice. That's true for all of us, yeah? I mean, there is, if conditions are so positive in your life that you don't know dukkha, well, what's the motivation to come here and do meditation? You know, meditation is a skill that takes some practice, you know, and over an extended period of time, generally. Some people take to it a little more quickly than others, but, you know, you've got to go through the hard times there if you want to do it. It's that dukkha. It's our experience of that dukkha and our understanding of how that can, how there can be, it is possible to gain some level of reduction in that dukkha, some level of freedom from that, that keeps bringing us back there. So we can use that, we can reflect on that dukkha in a positive way. So what supports it? And as I mentioned at the beginning, the Buddha taught a three-step process. When, in particular, when working with lay people, I think most of the spiritual practitioners in that time were seen as being strong enough in generosity or ethical conduct, though not always by any stretch. But he taught them that, you know, the generosity and then the ethical conduct. And then he would move on to the meditation itself. And, you know, the same is true with us here. If you haven't already, you can engage with dana as a practice in its own right. And I'm not talking about the dana basket. You can do with the dana basket as you would normally. For tonight, I'm not talking about the dana basket. But the practice of dana is a practice that has tremendous depth to it. Tremendous depth to it. The Buddha didn't teach it as kind of like, oh, well, these are really, you know, basic, boring things, you know, it's because you're totally corrupt and I'm teaching you these things. No, it's like these are the balances to the practice. You know, we've got dana on one side, we've got ethical conduct on the other. These serve to really create a strong foundation for our practice. And they cultivate, they can bring about through our work with generosity, through our work with ethical conduct, it can really bring about so much calming in the mind, such greater ease. I've told this story many times of how when I was a monk in Burma, my practice was going terribly. And so I started working more clearly with ethical conduct. And I started actually noticing it really in a much more fine-tuned way. Initially, I was just kind of doing it. It's like I had this kind of cavalier attitude. You know, look, I've been on retreat before. I know how to take the five precepts. I've done that. Okay, and these other people who don't know that, you know. Okay. And but as I really started to get into it as a practice, it really became very clear, and I was really working with it quite closely in a quite fine-grained way. And that was really, I think that was probably the biggest benefit that I got from my practice during the time that I was there. And that was a godsend for me, or a Buddha send, or whatever, I don't know. It was a real blessing for my practice, a real blessing for that. And as I started to work with it, after I'd been working with it and getting more and more fine-tuned with it, we were supposed to retake the precepts whenever we had broken a precept. And at the very least, we were supposed to retake them every week. And so I kind of grudgingly went to this thing for a while. But then as I started to work with it, work with the precepts and ethical conduct much more closely in a more fine-grained way, I would show up at my interview, you know, every 2 or 3 days, every day, 1 to 3 days, I would tell my preceptor that I needed to retake the precepts. You know, he had no judgment at all. His only concern was that if I'd broken the precepts, I needed to retake them so that I would be protected by them. That was what he was concerned about. Okay. So I would redo that. And I didn't like being out walking on the trails at night. There were no lights out there, so it was really dark, and I'd be stumbling through the woods. I had this little flashlight. It was unpleasant, and you know, often it would be raining, and the trails are creeks. They're the creek beds there, or the waterfalls, the cataracts kind of that would come down there. And I just had a lot of some kind of aversion to it. And I asked the senior monk who was the one who did this evening taking of the precepts for the seminaries. I said, you know, do I still have to come to this? And he's like, no, you're fine. And I really got the clear sense that he had the sense that I was practicing quite skillfully with the precepts, that I understood it on whatever level, as best I could, I understood it as a practice and was doing that. And he felt fine with trusting me to do that, that I would come and retake them with my preceptor when I needed to. So this is possible for all of you to work with this, to work with ethical conduct in this way. What does that mean? What does that mean, not causing harm? What does that mean, not taking what's not freely offered? Adinna dana. That's dana, that's what's given. And adinna, not freely given. What does that mean? What are all the parameters there? Are all the different possible ways in which we may be taking what's not freely given at the potluck in terms of privilege that we have that we don't clearly see in society. All of these ways, there's a tremendous riches in here that are available to all of us. Okay? And these things really help to create the positive feedback loop. Yeah. As we gladden the heart, that brings more gratitude, and gratitude brings more gladdening of the heart, and our generosity brings more gladdening of the heart, and our ethical conduct, seeing that, brings more calm to the mind, and we can take refuge in that. And it brings more in that way. Sila, ethical conduct. Another thing to reflect on. This is fully 1/3 of the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah? The Buddha was saying, this is important. Pay attention. Work with them solo. Work with them with a buddy. Work with them with a small group. Work with generosity. Whatever you want. You could work with these for... You could easily work with these for a year, 2 years, 5 years, you know, whatever, as your main practice. So if you want to work with the gladdening the mind heart, start by sitting. And I'd probably recommend starting with it as a formal practice, as a formal sitting practice, and then kind of going from there. And seeing how you can expand it out into your life, into your daily life, in ways that are skillful. But reflecting on wholesome topics, the Buddha and the monastics, inspiring Dharma stories that you've heard. Whatever it is for you. You know, perhaps it's recently in the last 10, 15 years in the Bay Area, there have been a number of nuns who have come here. Or the full ordination of the nuns? Wow, who can't get inspired by that? Well, maybe it's not inspiring for you. If it is, though, think about that. Reflect on the causes and conditions. Reflect on all the people who were there. Reflect on the monks who were there at that, at the ordination of the, at the full ordination of the nuns, showing their support in that way. Reflecting on times you were generous, with tangible resources or intangible things. The fact that your work has you working with people in difficult situations, well, there's a certain amount that's your responsibility. And there's also, I would bet for everybody who's doing that, if you pay close attention, the caring, some level of that caring is extra. Pay attention to that. Yeah? If you're a nurse, you're a therapist, a social worker, pay attention to that. Take, allow this to gladden the heart. This is quite skillful. You're a teacher or a tutor. You're a lawyer. You help people, connecting with that opportunity to help people. Yeah. Reflecting on times when you gave something. Reflecting on times you volunteered. Reflecting on some cause that you find that's very dear to your heart. It's very important for you. And maybe initially it was a soapbox for you and you were badgering people about it. But you also, there's some amount of learning that connecting with your wish that your actions be of service to the larger community, to the world as a whole, to all beings. Some of you I know have engaged with this in significant ways. You know, it's Mother's Day today. Connecting with mothers. You don't have to have a mother who you like in order to have gratitude for being born. You know, without her, you don't exist. You know? Reflecting on fathers who are difficult, whatever it is. You don't, I just want to put a little asterisk there. If your mother is the most challenging, difficult person for you in your life, you don't have to use her to start to cultivate your gladdening of the heart. That might be aversion, developing aversion in the heart. No, we don't have to go there. We have plenty of that already. So just play around. Feel what gives you that sense of gladdening there. Reflecting on the certain things that are blessings in your life. Yeah? The teachers that we have here. Philip Moffat, our main teacher. You know, I've told some other people here, and some of you have heard this from others as well. You know, if I'm out at Spirit Rock in the yurt and I'm seeing teachers I know who have been here, they talk about how great it is to teach here, how much they love coming to teach here. Yeah? Think about that. You know, there are people who we've had coming here this year who are like, I would love to come back here next year. People who would like to teach here more. Yeah? Reflect on that. Reflecting on that. Reflecting on the times in the evening here when there's a particular silence or stillness, or the feeling in the room when we're doing the metta. You know, just that feeling. Both the offering of metta to everyone and the receiving, the receptivity. The receptivity is such an important part in this practice. Such an important part. You know, the fact that we are on our own now as a Sangha, that the Sangha now is running the Sangha, and we're keeping ourselves afloat because of people's offerings to the Sangha. Yeah? This is wonderful. When you put money in that basket, please, please connect with the possibility of the Dharma being able to continue and the Sangha being able to continue. Please connect with that act of generosity just for yourselves. Yeah. Could be that for you, nature is really inspiring. The power of nature to heal. Hearing, you know, maybe at the beginning when you do your sitting down and just listening to the sounds of nature outside, birds in the morning, or I love the sounds of frogs. I used to live someplace where I'd hear the frogs in the evening, like from about February until July, you frogs in the night. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and the frogs going at it. Love that. Or, you know, maybe it's you go online. Go to Facebook. I don't go to Facebook often, but every once in a while I find these wonderful videos. These two really great videos. I saw this one of this little boy. He's probably 3.5, 4 years old. And he's the family's at some, it may just be a zoo or something, that there's at this exhibit with the with river otters. And this whole side is a glass wall. And the water comes up about halfway up the glass, maybe 4 to 6 feet high, 4 feet high, something like that. And this little boy is running back and forth, and one of the otters is diving in the water, chasing him the whole way down to the end. And the boy runs back, the otter goes up to the surface, gets water, follows him back this way, back and forth, over and over, until the boy starts to go back and forth quickly, and the otter's going back and forth. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. Wherever you find that inspiring stuff. It's other video that I saw. This elephant, these two elephants that had been in captivity their whole lives. The one had recently gone to this, been taken to this farm. I don't know if it was Tennessee, Kentucky, somewhere. And had been living there, and it had a lot more, you know, it would come into the barn in the evening, but in the day it got to go out, and they had a large area, and it had a stream running through it, a real stream, and all this kind of thing. And they brought this elephant there, that somebody had owned this elephant in Louisiana, and it had been kept with a chain around its ankle, and it had been there. This elephant with the chain around its ankle was now 52, and it had known this other elephant when they were each, when this 52-year-old elephant was 22, 30 years ago. And they bring it there, and the person who'd been its caretaker in Louisiana for many of the years, maybe not for all, but 30 of the years, like maybe the owner, he wasn't the owner of it, but maybe the owner had passed away or had to get rid of it. And so this guy had heard about this place. And so he makes sure he wants to get it to come to this place, get the elephant to come to this place. And so he's crying as he's saying goodbye. And then it shows the elephants reuniting. And that whole night, they were just trumpeting the whole night inside the barn together. And when they came in the morning, they had a hard time getting the gate open between the two enclosures they were in. It had gotten bent because they'd been pushing against it so hard. They were able to get it open, and they just stand there entwined, and they head outside in physical contact the whole way, the whole time. And it shows them standing there, and they go out and they go to the stream, and one of them lies down in the stream, and they're, you know, filling their trunks up with water, and then it shows them walking again right next to each other. Their trunks, one of them puts its trunk in between the other's legs, the other one's trunks caressing the other's face. You know, these beautiful things. See, the internet can be good for some things. So, another great story, that whale that got trapped in the crab pot lines outside the Golden Gate. I'm seeing some people haven't heard that, so that gives me permission to tell the story. Good. This was maybe 5 years ago, within the last 5 years, something like that, somewhere around that. I don't know, somewhere around that time frame. There was a whale just outside the Golden Gate that had gotten caught in some crab pot lines, and it was entangled in them, and there were like 6 or 8 lines all over its body, and it was going to drown because it was taking so much effort for it to get up to the surface. It was really struggling, And there was a boat out there that had seen them. So these people really hustled out there on a boat, scuba divers. They get out there, there's maybe six divers, and they get out there, and they set out to cutting these crab pot lines. And they do this, and the divers were saying they could look, you know, the eye was right there, and it was looking at them while they were doing this. And when they get the last of the lines cut, the whale goes, just starts to shimmy all over. It goes up to each of the divers, and it nuzzles each of them in turn, and turns around, gets the other one, and then it went off and breached, I think, or something. It just did. They clearly had the sense that this was an animal in just in complete joy and gratitude. Yeah. So, skillfully using this to inspire yourself, whatever brings that warmth to the heart can be quite skillful. You want to do this to bring that there. Then you can investigate that, or then you can head out into the world for the rest of your day from this place of this gladdened heart. Yeah? Everyone, a couple things. One is we don't want to use this as a way to get like giddy and that kind of thing, so staying grounded can be helpful. If you're an aversive type, it can be a very skillful practice. This is the practice of right effort. This is wise effort that the Buddha talked about, yeah? Cultivating the wholesome states of mind. The ones that you know, making them stronger. The ones that you don't know, starting to develop them. Yeah? So this is definitely right effort, wise effort here. Everyone may have their preset level of how gladdened your heart or mind is. But we also have some additional capacity to develop that. Yeah? So look at that. And I encourage you to engage with this, to have this as something that you put into your toolkit, that you work with in your daily practice, when you go on retreat, whatever works for you. Any questions or comments or thoughts?
Yes. When you asked who was an aversive type, I did not identify. And then during the entire talk, I proved myself to be a capital A aversive type. Because I kept arguing in my mind with so much of what you were saying. I just want to point out a few things, just a few. I see the concentration and the generosity. I mean, the concentration and the wisdom. Mm-hmm. Or the concentration and, yeah. Mm-hmm. As being the same, I understand that they're the same thing, but I also see generosity and ethical practice as being the same thing. There's a big overlap. I mean, maybe because when I was young, I was taught that generosity is an ethical practice. But I see them as being very similar, that the generosity falls under sila. I know it's sort of talked about separately, but it feels like it's almost an ethical imperative to be generous in this world.
I'm not sure I would say it that way.
It feels that way to me. I know that's not the way it was taught, or it is taught. But that was one of my aversion things, where it's like, wait, those are very similar.
Yeah. I think that, is the sound still on?
Yeah.
It is, okay. No, it's not. Yeah, something happened. Okay. I think that, maybe our battery went out.
It happened. I have two of them right here.
Okay. Okay. Here you go. Oh, it's on for right now. The battery's gonna. Okay, it's gonna go soon.
Needs it to be closed.
Okay. All right. Maybe I'll just. You want to take this and then I'll.
Talk
fast. I'll be on poised. Okay. Poised for action.
You'll be ready for action. It'll probably happen again soon. So. I think, to me, I think they have a lot of overlap. I think they both have a lot of benefits. I have some sense of why the Buddha taught the two of them before moving on to meditation. And I see them as aligned but somewhat different. Does somewhat distinct.
Let's just do it.
Yeah.
The other aversion came up in talking about the boy with the otter. I'm thinking, why is the otter in a confined space to begin with? And then with the whale, why are those pots out there anyway to trap animals? Right. So I had all these ethical arguments or aversive arguments to all these stories brought up in me, like wanting to fight back. So I guess I am an aversive type.
That's...
playing or hunting?
Oh, no. They don't think lions are prey. They know we're not their prey. But why was he in captivity, and why was the whale even caught up in those lines? So I was more concerned about the conditions that led to the entrapment of the whale and the entrapment of the otter, and how sweet that the boy played with the otter.
Yeah.
So
that's
aversive. That's aversion. I mean, that's me.
Sure.
Not
and both are, you know, and it depends on the person. To me, I went with my nephew. My nephew was out visiting a couple of years ago, and we went to the zoo, and boy, did I ever get depressed. You know? I mean, it's just so sad. And it is a part of this world. It is a part of this world. Take your joy where you can get it. Take your inspiration. And so for some of us, certain things are going to be inspiring or lead to that warming of the heart, and other things won't. So, yeah. No problem.
I just sounded funny that I didn't identify when you asked. And then all of a sudden, the entire time you're talking, it's like, that's a burden.
Yeah. Bodhisattva dog.
Oh, it's
a canine sauna.
Yeah.
I mean, and so I really cherish deeply that relationship, and she's my real dharma buddy.
Wonderful.
It's true.
Yes, Bill.
I had a thought also about generosity and sila, because I remember hearing this sometimes asked again, why are they different? And I realized that for me, and this is kind of a selfish viewpoint, generosity makes me feel good, whereas sila, in a sense, protects me. In the sense that, and it's very hard to meditate after a day of reaping and pillaging. Trust me. Not doing things, avoiding stealing. And avoiding stealing doesn't particularly make me gladden the heart, so generosity makes me feel good.
Yeah.
So I think of it as sort of a... And you know, right speech, when you say something that's right, that does feel good. But still, as a categorical thing, there's overlap, but there is something about generosity that's very close to gladdening the heart.
Yeah.
Whereas sila is sort of like, keeps me from getting messed up and...
Yeah, I think generosity can also show us a little bit where we're stuck, where we don't feel generous, where we don't feel okay about giving. No, well, this person's rude to me. I don't want to give them my attention. Oh, that's interesting. What's up with that? Well, you got to qualify, huh? You have to be this good a person in order to merit my attention, huh? You mentioned protection around sila, because that is one of the ways that it's taught, and that has been my experience. Of it being a protection. Protection from ourselves and our actions. Shoot, that was something else.
Because remorse is something that's really difficult to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seal up. Sooner or later, you'll have either a little bit or you'll have a lot, and it's just, you know, difficult to deal with.
Yeah, can be. Certainly can be. Let's go here.
I think it's possible to be generous without a moral consciousness. I mean, I think about, you know, the mafia of Don, who gives out money to all of his buddies and with dancing girls. There's a generosity there, but there's a lack of morality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a distinction between the two.
Mm-hmm. 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 Mm-hmm.
Would you give some examples of kind of subtler breaking of the precepts? You know, I mean, obviously you're not going to go steal from somebody or whatever,
right.
But more subtle kinds right. of breaking of the precepts.
Okay. So you're at a potluck, mm-hmm. and they're serving, there's, you see, at the end, there's the desserts, and you love brownies. And there's six brownies there. There's about 10 people at the potluck. And you take two. Okay. Yeah. Or something like that. Now, it's one thing if nobody else likes it. It's one thing if you go and you take half a brownie first and you leave that there, and then late in the evening, nobody else wants them. And you're like, oh, does anybody else want any ones? Okay, I'll take an extra, you know, whatever. Another thing is something that I'm interested in looking at with the Sangha is around privilege, you know, unearned privilege. Like, there's certain privileges that people have based on who they are, based on the color of our skin or age or gender, things like that. You know, what is the privilege that we have? There's certainly, I mean, as a straight, white, tall, middle-class, college-educated man, I can have a lot of privilege in a lot of ways. And if I'm not clear about what that is, it goes unnoticed. And in some way, that can be a taking what's not freely offered. Yeah?
How would you not take it?
That's a good question. I'm not... Well, so, say middle-class people, especially middle-class white people, tend to be good at working the system. Something happens, we're going to take it to the school board. We're going to, you know, if something happens at school, we'll take it to the school board. Well, first of all, we're going to be more likely to get our kids into the good schools, right? Because we know what the good schools are, and we've learned how to work the system, how to do the complaints, how to do the applications, all that kind of thing, to set ourselves up with a better opportunity ahead of time. And then if something happens, we're more likely to go to the school board to understand how that works. We're more likely to have the education that is going to coincide with that, yeah, with the people who are on the board, know how to speak in a way that they pay attention. So if we're clear about that, then we can simply, we can start to look at how can I not take advantage in this situation? How can I not... can I let go of getting the outcome that I want, and instead, what may be the best outcome for all involved?
I have a much more another concrete example of privilege. I work with underprivileged people in San Rafael, and many of them are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And I have noticed that they very often get jaywalking tickets where white
yeah.
people don't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Police in very many cities are just looking to harass or to make sure they're enforcing the law when it's somebody of color crossing the street or speeding. And I'm very conscious of that, and I do not jaywalk as I normally do in being a New Yorker. I used to just walk, and if I looked and no cars were coming, I would just cross the street. But I realize I can do that because of this color of my skin, and I'm not likely to be
right.
tagged for it. But since I work with people who frequently aren't tagged for it and are fined for it, who can barely afford it, I mean, they can't
yeah.
afford it, I'm very conscious of that. When I cross the street, I wait for the light to change. And it's just interesting to me that I wasn't conscious of that at all for the first 30 years of my life until I started working with this population. I saw the extent of the privilege. Speeding tickets, jaywalking tickets.
Yeah.
I mean, even disturbing the peace. I can be on the sidewalk laughing my head off with my friends, and nobody's going to call the police because I'm making too much. much noise. But the same noise from a different group of people, they're targeted as, let's call the police, they're making too much noise.
I have a great article that I want to put out on the Yahoo group about stop and frisk in New York City, which was the policy that the police could do a stop and frisk on anybody. Well, who they stopped and frisk? People of color. Especially black people, especially black men. Yeah.
They weren't pounding in the cheek?
Pounding in the cheek? Don't understand.
I'm just going to add, I think that there's a way all of us, when interacting with someone who doesn't have the same level of privilege that we have, if we fold, it can be just that we listen differently instead of trying to say, oh, well, they're not as educated, or they don't know the system, so I want to convince them, really, they should do it this way, and they're not as instead actually having the respect that they want to do it that way, and that's okay, because I think it can be hard to not feel like we're right, or we're right now. So sometimes it's just what those interactions one-on-one look like.
When I was working, I noticed that people, different people in the company would use their position as an opportunity to get what they wanted. Mm-hmm. And it was a very subtle kind of behavior, but it was very accepted. I mean, it was something that people just took for granted. Well, I'm a manager, so I should be able to blah, blah, blah. Didn't matter that they were an idiot or the other thing that I want to say about generosity, I grew up thinking that being taught that you were generous and you gave and then you would die and go to heaven, right? There was always a reward for generosity. And when I started to practice, I practiced and I really focused in on what generosity meant. I realized, ethics notwithstanding, that there's a generosity for its own sake. That you do that not because it feels good, not because you're going to die and go to heaven, but because it is in its own sake just a good thing to do.
Because that's your values, because that's what matters to you.
And
it's also, it's a challenge. I know I've heard, I don't know if I heard Joseph say this, I think I heard him say it in a Dharma talk. Joseph Goldstein, one of the teachers at IMS back east, talked about how he had, when he was during the time that he was in India, at one point he went to the market and he bought a large bag of oranges. And a lot of people who beg in India, and there was a little boy begging, and he just he just decided he had this bag of oranges. He was going to give them to a lot of the kids who were begging, and he gave one to this kid, and the kid took it and turned without any ounce, without an ounce of energetic acknowledgement of the gift. And he was a little taken aback by it. He's like, oh, well, I guess maybe I was not giving it as freely as I thought. So that can be a very fruitful exploration, And of course, it doesn't mean that it has to feel great when somebody does that, but that we connect with, if we really are giving, are connecting with our value to give. Our value to be generous, Alice.
I just noticed that I think that if you go to a Buddhist culture like Thailand or India, the people there have a belief, I think I've heard, where if they give money to the monks or they give whatever they, that they will have a better next life.
Next lifetime.
And I don't know if that's
born in one of the heavenly realms.
That's misguided. It's, they do not want to be a Buddhist.
I think it's just a shadow. It's just the shadow of that, of those cultures,
But it works. The monks they kind of like that. Oh, yeah, I get more because they believe that I can do something for them.
Yeah. Ajahn Sumedho has this, talks about that quite a bit. Talking about how people would come and they would want these little Buddha trinkets. And he's like, they think that's going to save them, Like, taking refuge in Buddha trinkets is taking refuge in, what is it made of? Like, clay and metal. It's like, taking refuge in that is taking refuge in clay and metal. They could just be taking refuge in the Buddha instead, if they wanted. So we take, we're human. We have our delusion, and different cultures have it in different ways. In to my way of thinking, that's simply the shadow side of that, of how that gets expressed there. You know, there can be really tremendous generosity in a lot of ways, and then we also see that kind of thing, giving to get.
Yeah, I always wondered when doing it in certain organizations or under certain circumstances, donors are always getting paid back.
Yeah.
Which always bothered me. And if you're so poor that you want me to give you my money to help the children or to help the opera or the ballet or the library, why are you then buying me dinner? I think this is just a really big topic. And although I really appreciated, I don't mean to engage in crosstalk, but I really appreciated your discernment about the CLO versus the generosity. But I know growing up in my family, there was always a box that you had to put your change into, and that was for charity. And that's part of the religion of my historical family. And I think that's true in a lot of cultures. I used to have a Japanese friend from Japan who never stepped into my house without giving me something. I think it was just, and she was the most humble being, would never take it, didn't even want to hear a thank you. So I think that is woven into, you know, there are religions where people tithe.
Yeah.
And I just think that that is an ethical sort of, I don't know, social, cultural, ethical value woven into a lot of societies.
It can be. And I think my understanding is of the way the Buddha taught it was not as an imperative, not as a do it or else, but as a teaching, as a practice. As a practice.